One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and of course, as always, sitting across from me here is this fella here rolling around with his mouse, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I am glad to be here. Super excited.
This is going to be a good one. We had some fun. We've been talking about a bunch of stuff off air. Me and Kyle been in here chatting it up like normal. Of course, we chatted up most of the time all day, every day, but today we were talking about a little fishing and a little offshore fishing down in Louisiana, because I want to run down there. And, of course, I'm a big fan of Louisiana, and I love the food and all that stuff. And then Kyle pops this on me. He's like, well, I'm glad you brought that up. I got to tell you something on the show. So, Kyle, without any further ado, my friend, what were you going to tell me about what's going on in Louisiana?
Well, there's an interesting article I saw where Louisiana's disappearing coast is actually taking ancient history with it.
Whoa.
You know, as the sea levels rise, there's these ancient sites, Native American sites, and as the water's rising, it's taking away that history. Pot shards and things like that are being swept away. They talk about it being called saltwater intrusion, and they say as the sea levels rise, like they say, industry is a big problem, even for the environment and the economy. But it could also change our understanding of the state's history. In some places, the water is taking with it ancient Native American sites, posing challenges for archaeologists. Let's listen to this.
Richie Blink is a community organizer for the National Wildlife Federation in Plaquemines Parish, where he grew up. When he was a kid, his dad showed him a special place. With little Richie at the helm, they would head out to fish in Bay Adams near Empire, about an hour south of New Orleans on the West Bank. After leaving the docks, they would wind through the waterways and to the floodgates, which opened to the wide open bay.
We'd come out of the floodgates, and my dad would say, head for the lemon trees.
The lemon trees. A stand of weathered old trees on a grassy tuft of land, it's a well-known landmark for fishermen, but they would rarely stop there to hunt or fish because it's a sacred Native American site.
The older folks, you know, always discourage us going out of respect.
But some people did go. In fact, that's how the lemon trees got there.
The legend goes that you should always bring some sort of sacrifice. So somebody left some lemons for the ancestors.
And those lemons grew into big trees with grapefruit-sized lemons. But then they stopped producing fruit. They started dying off. As land was lost, salt water made its way into the freshwater marsh, killing off the trees and other plants. Blink watched from afar as they became dead trunks, like skeletons. Respecting the place used to mean not going there.
Now that it's actually washing away, I think it's important that, you know, it needs to be seen before it's lost.
To document the place, to track its damage, and to save something from it before it all dissolved, Blink started to head for the lemon trees and go directly ashore. Now the island that used to hold a citrus grove has only a few live trees at all. The edges of this scrappy, wind-beaten patch of land are crumbling. Waves beat against the dirt, washing it away, exposing shards of ancient pottery. Blink hops down off his boat, pulls it up on the eroding bank, and reaches down to pick up an unassuming ground shard out of the waves.
You could see it's just everywhere, all over the place.
What do you have there?
This is earthen pottery, made by natives. And this site is in the process of being destroyed. It only has a few more years left.
It's an ancient Native American site and an important archaeological find. And it's one of many historic sites being lost to the Gulf as rising seas and saltwater intrusion eat away at Louisiana's fragile marshes. When Blink saw how fast it was eroding, he decided to find an archaeologist and ask for help. He saw an op-ed about another endangered historic site and called the writer, Brian Ostahowski. Ostahowski works as an investigator with a private archaeology company, Search Inc. And he gets a lot of calls like this, at least once a month. People who say,
I have a great archaeological site in my backyard. Chances are they probably do.
So he hopped in a boat with Richie Blink and went out there.
Richie wasn't lying. This is actually a very, very important archaeological site.
Based on the pottery and the soils, Ostahowski says native people lived at the site 300 to 500 years ago. And the pieces of broken pottery are probably from an ancient trash pile called a midden. There could even be human remains there.
You're talking about a whole ceremonial center that could tell you about lifeways or the change of lifeways that's going to be completely gone within 10 years. It maybe took 300 years of occupation there.
300 years to build it? In just 10 years, it could be erased.
Now, this Ostahowski, he took samples of the soil for radiocarbon dating, and he wants to learn more, like for how long people lived there and how many different occupations there might have been. These details could help fill gaps in our understanding of the prehistoric culture of what's called the Bayou Petre phase. But the truth is, there isn't much time. He's talking about there's no way to slow this process down, and so we have to do the archaeological digs right now. We have to do them really fast before the water just swallows up all this stuff, and this stuff will be lost forever. I mean, and how many other times has this happened in the years, you know, years gone by? I was just recently reading a book by Mark Adams about the lost city of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Similar story. You know, it's some people say it never existed. Other people claim that it did exist and that it was, you know, swallowed up by the ocean. Well, we know that this happens. We know back that throughout history, there's all these stories, Noah's Ark, all these great deluge stories, you know, of these flood. So we know what's happened before. And right now we are noticing that the Arctic is thawing and the oceans are rising. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it before. The small island country of like the Maldives and stuff, those are going to be gone in the next 100 years. There's nothing we can do to stop it. So if all these archaeological sites that are right on the coast, when the sea level rises, it's gone forever.
Man.
You know, and that's the same thing where people talk about like the, what's the Japanese site? Yonaguni.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, I know Robert Schock talks about that, it's not man-made, and then, you know, he has a way to explain why it's not. But I know there's other people that say that, no, it looks like it was an ancient city that was swallowed up by the sea. I don't know, but this stuff is happening, so pretty interesting.
Well, and it's not like archaeological job isn't hard enough already. Now you're under the gun. Now you're like, were we talking at one time, whenever we were talking about them bringing up the fossils of dinosaurs, when they would wash out of the rivers and they would have only certain amounts of time when the water would recede, that they had to get in there and get them out before the waters filled back up in those rivers. So,
right.
Man, it's a bummer for what happens. Knowing what it is, maybe, you know, of course, we're going to do a lot of changing, but maybe these guys will throw some more money at it and let's get in there and get after it and get some stuff saved and taken care of.
Yeah, hopefully.
I don't know if you saw this. We've discussed this numerous times, Kyle, but about the MH370, the missing Malaysian plane, right?
Yeah.
This comes from the Express. This is pretty strange. They believe it's been found on Google Earth. Now, there's an ex-U.S. Air Force fella claims this. Says he's a UFO investigator, was looking for evidence of flying saucers, and inadvertently stumbled across the suspected aircraft in an 8-month-old Google satellite image. Says if Scott C. Waring is correct, the plane had traveled to the Cape of Good Hope off Cape Town, South Africa. Now, his claim today coincides with the discovery of debris on the east coast of Africa in the area between Mozambique and Madagascar. Now, we discussed this. Now, it says the wrecked parts are being sent, of course, to Australia for tests to see if they came from the MH370. Now, Mr. Waring, who's the editor of UFO Sightings Daily, posted details about this discovery that he had made online. And he says that he's discovered the aircraft, and it would appear that this plane had survived. Now, this is what's strange. If you look at the picture, it looks like it's completely one piece, like largely one piece.
I'm looking at the picture, yeah.
Is that not crazy?
Yeah.
Now, like we talked about, it disappeared back on March 8th of 2014, and then, of course, the site of the debris find is 1,200 miles from Cape Town. Now, Warren goes on to say, and like I said, it comes from here, John Austin actually published all this. Now, I guess what Warren had actually published on his site was on his blog that I was looking around the Cape of Good Hope for an old UFO sighting I found 3 years ago and was hoping to make an update when I came across a shadow in the water which resembled an airliner. So now I used to work on B-1 bombers back at Ellsworth, South Dakota at the SAC during my USAF days. I know a plane when I see one. Now he says he speculated that the Boeing 777 like the MH370, would have enough fuel to fly between 6,000 and 7,700 miles, and the crash site was about 5,400 from where it actually took off. And he goes on to say that Google Earth photos dated July 26, 2015, it crashed on March 8th of 2014, so it's had 16 months of moving about. He says now he fears that it could have moved since a picture was taken last July. He said action was needed urgently to confirm or rule out his findings. Now, this is another thing that he says. He said, I know that there's less than a 1% of a chance that this is MH370, but it's better than we had 5 minutes ago. He said, now I feel awful for those families who lost friends and family on this plane, and I hope that this might give them some sort of closure.
Well, I'm looking at the pictures, and the only thing I could say is, but it looks like the airplane's completely intact.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be, you know, damaged? Wouldn't the wings be ripped off?
You would think. Now, that's there's a lot of scientists right now that have seen that are saying that he's simply falling into that phenomenon. What is it? Pareidolia?
Where your brain sees something.
Exactly. That they think that it's just textures and rocks and just the way it's lined out, and he's seeing that. But apparently he's been tweeting, and he's trying to get up to the Malaysian airline people and all stuff. Look, stranger things have happened. We've covered that on this show numerous times. I mean, it could be, but like you and I have already said, something's up with that crash because they didn't find a lot of debris. They didn't find any like oil slick. So it's like it didn't break apart. It's like the ocean opened up and just sucked it in a hole down there, and that was it. So I don't know. The picture looks almost too good to be true.
That's what I'm saying. It looks like it's completely intact. Here's the thing. It'd be real easy to go where that is and search. It wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
And if there's nothing there, there's nothing there. If
run another a sonar scan over the area or something, yeah. See what happens. You're exactly right. But so I don't know, man. I still hope that they find something just to give it closure. I'm with him. It needs to have some sort of closure.
Right. Pretty cool. I was reading an article recently, and they were talking about the search for extraterrestrial creatures, and they were talking about if an extraterrestrial observer called us, would anybody even hear it? Now, as scientists step up their search for life in the universe, two astrophysicists are proposing a new way to make sure we don't miss the signal if an extraterrestrial observer tries to contact us. Renee Heller and Ralph Pudritz say the best chance for us finding a signal from beyond is to presume that extraterrestrial observers are using the same methods to search for us that we are using to search for them. Now, here on Earth, space researchers are focusing most of their search efforts on planets and moons that are too far away to see directly. Instead, they study them by tracking their shadows as they pass in front of their own host stars. Now, measuring the dimming of starlight as a planet crosses the face of its star during orbit, scientists can then collect a wealth of information even without ever seeing the worlds directly. Now, using methods that allow them to estimate the average stellar illumination and temperatures on their surfaces, scientists have already identified dozens of locations where life could potentially exist. In a paper published in the Journal of Astrobiology, I know you're subscribed to that.
I've got the newest episode coming, or the newest publishing of it at my house right now.
Well, in that periodical, Heller and Pudritz turned the telescope around to ask, what if extraterrestrial observers discover the Earth as it transits in front of our sun? Now, if such observers are using the same search methods that scientists are using here on Earth, the researchers could propose that humanity should turn its collective ear to Earth's transit zone. The thin slice of space from which our planet's passage in front of the sun can be detected. So basically they're saying we use a method of where we could see planets and stuff without ever seeing them directly, just by watching them pass in front of their host stars.
Mm-hmm.
What if these extraterrestrials are doing the exact same thing? We could maybe help them out a little better by searching the areas where we transit from in front of our own sun.
I guess.
And that might lead to them discovering us. Because if they're watching that, extraterrestrials might know exactly where we are. They might have known about this for hundreds of thousands of years. And of course, they could have also already visited Earth. They would definitely know if they're using the techniques that we're using that planet Earth is habitable. Mm-hmm. They would know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, have they been here? I mean, some people say they're living amongst us now.
Oh, great.
Pretty interesting.
I hope if they're not here, I hope they don't show up. I don't think it would ever end well. I always say that. I just don't think it would end well. Nobody that's way more advanced than another thing always seems to want to put it in a zoo or something, and I don't want to be part of a zoo.
Well, throughout time, like, you know, you're talking about the Spanish conquistadors and things, throughout times when other people, other civilizations show up on your shores, it never works
out. And they're way more advanced than you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it never works out well.
I hope they never arrive.
Yeah, exactly, right? Well, it's funny that you bring that up. Look, I was looking in some news stories, and something hit me, and then I kind of went back and did a little bit of a looking, and you and I were talking about cloning animals, you know, back in the day, and there's some other things I didn't even know they were thinking of doing. I'm just going to touch on this before I get to this news story. Are you familiar with the short-faced bear?
No.
Apparently in North America, 800,000 years ago. Now, they say it completely disappeared, strangely enough, 11,000 years ago, around the time that the megafauna, you know, was disappearing around this area. And it says that some people believe it still lives somewhere in the forest of Western Canada, but the short-faced bear was the largest bear species ever to exist. Well, they're thinking about wanting to clone this thing.
Okay.
Yeah, this is what they want to do. They said that it indicates shoulder height of the short-faced bear. Shoulder height, more than 6 feet. The largest bear species on the planet's shoulder height is around 4 to 5 on average.
Like a polar bear?
Yeah, so I'm guessing on all fours, the shoulder height. This is more than 6 feet on all fours.
Oh, come on. The polar bear's shoulders are higher than that.
Not on all fours.
Oh, they'd not on all fours. Up. Okay,
they're talking on all fours.
Eww.
Yeah. They said it wouldn't be a problem. Get a load of this. They've apparently...
Wouldn't be a problem. Sounds like a huge problem. Why would you want to reinvent that?
To clone it? Yeah, now you're talking about a real monster. They're talking about cloning it. They said it's not a big deal. I love how we're just like, oh, we can clone that. It's no big deal. We can clone that. They've already got salvaged DNA where they had found them frozen in the permafrost. They've got all the DNA they said that they could need. Here's what's cool, though. Their closest relative is like some kind of Eurasian a bear that's only 2 or 3 foot tall at the shoulder. So they said that could pose a little minor problem during the development stage of the embryo. But it goes on to talk about saber-toothed cats. They're talking about they wanted to bring those back. And I believe you and I had even touched on that at one time. And they got those recent bodies for the DNA out of those out of the La Brea tar pits in L.A.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that story. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, then the dodo bird. The dodo bird, they've actually wanted to talk about bringing it back too because, of course, it was basically exterminated in the 17th century by Dutch sailors. They were eating them, you know, and doing. They were 3 foot tall, flightless birds. Not a good thing. Here's another part of the list, too, that we love. Thylacine.
Yes.
What was it? 79? I want to say it was 79 or 80 years ago, whenever it finally died, as far as what they know was the last one. But they've actually got its DNA mapped, and they believe that they could actually bring it back. I don't believe they need to bring it back. I think it's still there.
I do, too.
Our brothers from Australian mothers, Chris and Waz down there, those guys have got all kinds of information about it. But I touch on all that because now we're talking about bringing back monsters. Scientists are trying to clone Ice Age cave lions.
Well, that sounds like a great idea.
From 12,000-year-old remains. It says they're hoping to use a revolutionary new DNA technique.
Why are they trying to bring these monsters back? I can see the dodo bird I'm totally fine with.
Because it doesn't get you.
Yeah, let's bring back some extinct animals that aren't harmful.
Yeah.
Not bears. Not lions.
We don't need giant cave lions and monster short-faced bears on this planet. Scary enough as it is, y'all. Scary enough. Well, apparently they found some remains back in August of 2015 of two lion cubs, and they actually named these dead cubs Dinah and Yuan, and they were found in a remote area in the Republic of Russia's northwest called Sakha. And apparently they were the best remaining examples, they say, of the species of these big cats. So what do? They're going to start checking them out. Here's the thing. This project's a joint venture by Russian and South Korean scientists at the Joint Foundation of Molecular Paleontology at Northeast Russia University. Okay, so these guys, I keep thinking of like Man Bear Pig is what they're building up there in a place like that, because they're doing whatever they want to do. What they're wanting to do is take one of the clones, one of the cubs, and use it for cloning, and then they want to use the other one to be kept in a museum, because since they've got the twins. So, and here's Dr. Albert Protopopov. Now, he's head of the Mammoth Fauna Studies Department at the Yakuin Academy of Science. And this is what he says. Now, he told this to Siberian Times, that this find, beyond any doubt, is sensational. The cubs are complete with all their body parts, fur, ears, soft tissue, and even whiskers. And together with the Mammoth Museum, we took samples for cell research. Now, comparing with modern lion cubs, we think that these two were very small, maybe a week or two old. The eyes were not quite open. They have baby teeth, and not all had appeared. So now they're talking to a cloning expert from South Korea. Now, his name
is... Always the Koreans. They're always into the cloning.
Yeah. This fella's name is Hwang Woo Suk.
Really?
Hwang Woo Suk is conducting pioneer research to bring back the woolly mammoth. And he took the sample of one of the cave lion cubs and all this. And he believes that he's actually going to be part of the autopsy to be done this year on the cub that they're going to try to use for cloning. I don't know if I'd trust a cloning expert named Hwang Woo Suk, but what do I know? Not a cloning expert.
So you mean in the future, in the decades to come, I'm going to be able to go to this wildlife refuge and watch an actual mammoth be killed by cave lions?
I would not be surprised if that doesn't become something. What I keep picturing is there's going to be kind of like a Jurassic Park zoo, but it's going to be like these extinct mammals. But how long? This is what I keep thinking. How long until it becomes an accepted thing? Like, oh, it was extinct. I'm sure the first 10 years is really neat that people have got this out there. And then in another 30 or 40 years, and they breeding on their own, and then somebody gets one as a pet, smuggles it out, and then it's back on the... The next thing you know is it's just, oh, there was a time period for a small time period that these weren't... These were extinct, now they're not, you know, and then how do we know this in the history books? And there's so many questions. This just shakes up the whole thing.
Well, much like Jurassic Park, they're doing the same thing. They're trying to bring back... What is the newest Jurassic Park about? They wanted to invent something scarier. So they created this Indominus Rex.
Let's not do that.
That's exactly what they're doing. They're finding, there's millions of animals they can find to clone, but they're only choosing dangerous ones.
The scary ones.
Because they know that's what's going to sell in a theme park.
Yeah. Yeah.
People want to see teeth.
Nobody's cloning a slug. Nobody's like, I'm going to clone a giant snail. There was a snail that was three foot tall at the shell. I'm cloning me a giant snail. Nobody's doing that. Although you could sell a lot of escargot. I'm just throwing that out there, folks. You might want to think about that. But nobody's cloning that. Nobody's like, let's clone some big fish that are good to eat. Let's clone some giant tuna fish and put them in the ocean. Let's do that. No, let's clone like 12-foot tall, short-faced monsters and giant cave lions. Let's do that.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. I don't know what people are thinking.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Well, that's it for the news, folks. Let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, Cam's going to get into some interesting stories about crop circles. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And we are back, guys. Okay, we've been asked to cover this, and I'm going to go ahead and jump in this whole thing. I'm going to do my best. There's a lot of stuff to it. There's a lot of everything. You know, it could be this, it could be that. It makes some really interesting stories. I know I love looking at the pictures of them because I'm blown away with how awesome that they look. And I mean, they would make posters. I mean, too bad. I'm sure they're out there. I didn't look into that, but it would be neat to have like a posters of some of the cooler ones that are really, really intricate of these crop circles. And when I hear the term crop circle, the first thing that pops into my mind, of course, is this shaggy haired English gentleman that I saw as I was a young man. I watched it on the Discovery Channel. Now, this fella's name is Colin Andrews. And if you don't know Colin or his work, you should really take a look into it, because to me, he's kind of like the godfather of all this crop circle research. So much so that he's the man that coined the term crop circle. Did you know that, Philly?
I did not.
Now, you know who I'm talking about when I talk about Colin. Now, he's formerly of Andover, England. He was electrical engineer for over 10 years with the British government. Now, he says that he saw his first crop circle in 1983. Now, he founded Circles Phenomenon Research International later that same year, and then he dedicated himself completely to trying to decipher and figure this whole thing out. And even in 89, he co-authored a book called Circular Evidence. That's with Pat Delgado. And then, of course, it went on. Then Colin does all these, he did lectures and all this. And he's also into remote viewing. Colin's really big into remote viewing, into dowsing and all this. He's traveled all around and been on all kinds of television shows and all this. I do remember that it came to a shock to a lot of people, because on national television that he stated between the years of 1999 and 2000 that only about 20% of the crop circles researched remained a mystery, kind of inferring to everybody around him that the remaining 80% were man-made. And that he publicly stated that since 1980, that the phenomenon indicates a future period of human chaos. And he says that this period indicated, supported by current trends, can be changed with human awareness. And he believes that they're so serious that this eco-political implications, that the future direction of the planet is at the center of this phenomenon. Now, that sounds crazy when you start talking about that. Now, this show isn't to promote Colin, but I did feel it very necessary that I tip my hat to this man that first brought this to my attention. Now, I wanted to start off on the right foot by showing everybody that it's truly really been looked into, that this isn't just something that's just kind of haphazardly talked about, that there are people that have dedicated themselves to trying to understand this. And if y'all are anything like me, you probably already had your mind made up about this topic without really looking too deep into it, because I was the exact same way. I didn't think anything of it. You know, I remember seeing some stuff about it, didn't think anything of it until researching the show. So with saying that, let's just take a little trip. Let's dive off into this crop circle thing. Now, when I say crop circle or crop formation, I'm talking about a pattern that's created by the flattening of stems and of crops. And most of these crops are like a wheat crop, something that we would use to eat. And you're not going to do it like giant cornfields. Certain crops you can't do it in, of course. Now, the crop circle, of course, as the name implies, almost always involve circles. Rarely triangles, rarely ever rectangles or squares. Now, there's some designs contain straight lines, and some even have some curved lines, but the circle's the easiest pattern, what they believe, for hoaxers to create.
Okay? Yeah.
It's also a nocturnal thing, that they're formed overnight. Now, they're often found, of course, by farmers or by people driving to and from work the next morning. Now, there seems, of course, no logical reason for extraterrestrials or even Earth folk to be out there to be creating these patterns only at night. The only advantage that would be was for a hoaxer to create this under the cover of darkness, you know, especially like a full moon, you wouldn't hardly need any light at all to do what you do.
Right.
Now, they say that crop circles have never been recorded being made. Of course, there's always been videos of these orbs or these lights hitting it and stuff. And
there they are.
That's most all of that has been proven to be fake. Every bit of it. Yes. They also say there's no obvious human trait that are traced, that there's no, that most crop circles show little or no signs of human contact. Well, in fact, they say that hoaxers devoted a lot of time to make sure that they have these certain shapes and these certain patterns that they use that would be easily brushed off as, well, nobody could come in here and do that.
Right.
Now, I'm throwing a lot of this stuff out, too. Now, access to roads, they even point to, that a lot of them are very close to the fields where it's easily publicly accessible or easily seen from the highway.
Well, that makes sense, because if you're going to hoax, you're going to go out there and create a crop circle. What's the point of doing it if no one's going to see it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You get into that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not saying that it's a hoax, because I don't necessarily know It's like we always talk about. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of hoaxes. Apparently, the man that even studies it his whole basically adult life believes that 80% of them are hoaxes.
But what about that 20%?
20% is the thing that gets to me.
Yeah.
Because you look at some of this, you're like, okay, and I'm going to get into that. Now, we think of them as a recent thing, but I got to looking, and there's a one that's actually a case from 1678 called the Mowing Devil. And it's in which there's a farmer's field was said, he had said, that was visited by a devil or a devilish entity that trampled the crops down. Now, there's a woodcut made of this, and it actually was there to illustrate in the folklore of the Mowing Devil legend. And like I said, the legend is there's an English farmer told a worker who he was feuding with that he would rather pay the devil himself to cut his oat field than pay for the fee that this man was demanding. Now, the source of the harvesting is not known, but it does look like in the woodcut that the devil himself is holding like a scythe, a sickle down there, cutting it. Now, of course, according to the original text on the on this woodcut, the legend says that the devil cut them in round circles and placed every straw with the exactness that it would have taken up above an age for any man to perform what he did in one night.
Hmm.
So they believe, okay, it goes into the folklore of this whole thing, of the devils out there doing
right.
it. Which, how else would you actually, you know, talk about this? Now, there's a crop circle researcher by the name of Jim Schnabel, and he really doesn't consider it to be a historical precedent because he describes the stalks as being cut rather than bent. Now, we're going to get into talking about the bent things, but here's something else. There was a naturalist, a British naturalist, by the name of Robert Plott. And in 1686, he actually reported rings, or what he said was arcs, of mushrooms in the Natural History of Staffordshire. Okay, he saw these. He's and it's kind of like a fairy ring is what he's talking about, is seeing the way these things were growing in these fairy rings.
Right.
And at the time, 1686, he believed that it was from the airflow from the sky. Maybe swirling winds caused these things to grow in spores in these circular areas. What made them pop up. So you jump into, there's a meteorologist named Terence Meaden, and in 1991, he linked this report to modern crop circles, and they was about this swirling winds, and Eric Von Daniken himself, whom hopefully we get to sit down and have a chat with, he even compared to some of those too, of talking about maybe it was a swirling winds. But in 1880, there was a letter to the editor of Nature, and there was an amateur scientist named John Rand Capron, and he described how a recent storm had come through his farm and created several circles of flattened crops in a field. But in 1932, there was an archaeologist named E.C. Kerwin, and he observed four dark rings in a field at Stroughton Down near Chichester. And he said he could only examine one. And this is what he says, a circle in which the barley was logged or beaten down while the interior or was very slightly mounded up.
Hmm.
Now, Dr. Kerwin goes on to, he actually makes a diagram, and he also took some photos of this cluster of crop circles
right.
in 1932. Now, his photo was taken from a hill there named Bow Hill, and it's the first known photo of a crop circle. So what we all think of it is in the 1980s. This is coming from 1932.
Right. Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
And I'm saying that because I'm going to talk about some hoaxers here in a little bit. Now, like I said, it was taken because there's a very low angle from where it is on this hill. So he didn't have, you know, he didn't have a drone or a hot air balloon. So you can only see one of these circles, but it looks like a ring style crop circle. Now, of course, there's some analytical stuff was done on Kerwin's, and he actually drew a diagram. And he said it's most useful because it shows that the circles and their relationship to one another on the surrounding environment of that area. So there's several of them, of course, out there. And they said that's kind of interesting because of the interpretation of the formation of the circle by it's beside a fence, and the road did not stop the circle from forming in the field.
Oh.
So instead of it being out in the middle of the field, it actually formed near a road and a fence, and it just continued out there. So it'd be like you stuck it in there, and you just like, you know, like you drawing a circle on two sheets of paper. It didn't stop it. It was still perfect. So they were like, that's kind of strange. You jump on, there's a fella named Sir Patrick Moore. Now, I don't know what he did to get knighted, but he was an amateur astronomer. And in 1963, he described a crater that he saw in a potato field there in Wiltshire. And he proposed that it was probably caused by some unknown body like a meteorite. Maybe it struck in the nearby wheat fields. He goes on to say that there were several circular and elliptical areas where the wheat had been flattened. And he even goes on to say that there was evidence of spiral flattening. So not just pushed down in one way, but a spinning flattening. And that he thought it could be caused by air currents from the impact.
Yeah, I guess.
Since it led, he said it led towards the center. So as it spirals, it's twisting it towards the center. Which is another very strange thing. Now, there was another astronomer named Hugh Ernest Butler. And he had stated that he even observed similar craters. And he thought that they were likely caused by lightning strikes. So he's not talking about it being burnt, though. He's just talking about these craters in the ground, things like that. Now, there's a book been written by a fellow named Terry Wilson. It's called The Secret History of Crop Circles. And people claim that it is the most comprehensive record of pre-1978 crop circles. So he goes into in-depth of all this stuff. Now, he actually has a thesis that the crop circles have been occurring in the English countryside in very significant numbers for at least the past century, and that they are not the result of human activity. And he further suggests this. Now, this is a cool thing, that he claims that the artist that claimed to have created the majority of crop circles as a hoax is in itself a hoax.
Yeah, really?
That's what he says. Now, only around 1980 was, like we discussed, was there really any real serious attention finally kind of paid to these crop circles, and it's primarily in southern England, where 90% of these designs have been reported, okay?
Right.
Now, these designs, like we said, are basically simple circles, circles with rings, variations of Celtic crosses, things like that as it comes across. And then, of course, by the late 80s, they started developing straight lines, pictograms, they were close to like the petroglyphs that you see, you know, we talk about down there in the desert, but there's some more to it. I mean, you can basically pick out, and we know that they've even been used now for advertisements where there's people know how to build them. They have rollers, they have all this stuff, and go out. The idea of it being a circle or something in the field isn't out of this ordinary, you know. It's nothing crazy to think about, because you got to dig into this, okay? You got to really look into it. It's not so much about the shape and the sizes and the emblems and what they are. And the geometry of these, it's the fact of when you get into the crop circle itself. Now, I'm going to tell you this. After about the 1990s, of course, the designs, like I talked about, got extremely complex. They were jumping and jumping and jumping. And now, of course, there's these they call them crop glyphs. And it looks like, you know, fractal things that are coming off of all kinds of stuff. And it's crazy, the stuff that they're building now. And they've also increased in size. Some of them have gone up to 200,000 square feet. They know for a fact that there's been over 10,000 reported crop circles. There's even been people that have been taken to jail for damaging crops by sneaking into people's fields, right, you know, and building crop circles. But in 1991, this is what it was. There was a fella named Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley. Now, they came forward and they said, hey, we're the guys responsible for all this. In 1978, we started using this stuff, that they would take a baseball cap and they put like a loop of wire through it, you know, and they would put it on and they run that wire and then they would put a pole or something in the ground where they knew they were walking in straight lines, and then they would take like a plank of wood, and you've seen it with the rope on either end. They hold their feet and they step on it, and they step on it.
These are the stalks down.
To bend the stalks down. Exactly. And so much so that these guys got so much airplay at one time that this Pat Delgado that wrote the book with Colin, Doug and Dave actually went and got a bunch of journalists and said, hey, come here. This is what we're going to do. We're going to see if this guy knows what he's talking about. So what did they do? They make a crop circle. Then they bring Pat in, and Pat declares it authentic. He's examining it, goes through the whole thing. He's like, this is one of those crop circles. Then they come in and say, well, we're the guys that actually built it. So it kind of gives a black mark on the face of anybody doing any crop circle research. Is you're like, well, now who do we trust? You know, how do we know all this? What's going on? Now, they go on to say, Bauer and Chorley, that they were responsible for all the circles made prior to 1987. And for more than 200 crop circles from 78 to 91. But there was over 1,000 of them not being made by them.
Hmm.
All right. Now, They say they were inspired by the crop circle account from 1966 in Australia. Now, they go on. They start talking about this. Like I said, they said that the pictographs they created inspired a second wave of artists that were working, these artisans, crop artists. Now, that was Professor Richard Taylor. Now, in 1998, the surviving member of this duo, I believe it was Bauer, actually told the British newspaper this in private, that he had been felt like he had been guided by an unknown force when he started doing this, which makes it really strange in itself. That's a really strange statement. But okay, here's where things start to get weird. Now, I love saying that when we do a segment or we talk about anything. Like, it's not weird enough. Here's where things start to get weird. In genuine formations, the stems are not broken. This is something these guys didn't know, okay? This is something that they go out and did and all that stuff. They didn't have any idea that they were going to have, like we always talk about, the way, you know, we're like, put it on ice. Maybe in another 30 years, somebody will be able to cure it. You never know what's going to happen, you know, with the DNA. They would draw blood for these murders, and they didn't have any way of checking it, but they knew if they kept it long enough that technology would catch up to it sooner or later. I don't believe that they foresaw this technology because they're just out there having a good time pranking people. A couple of old dudes, I'm figuring them, you know, they're sitting around, they go have them a few pints. Next thing you know, like, all right, let's go make one just for giggles and let's see what happens.
Small town, nothing to do.
Exactly, right? You know, the fishing's not good. Maybe it's cold. Who knows? But anyway, it says in genuine formations, the stems are not broken, but they're bent, normally about an inch off the ground and near the plant's first node, first section before it sections out again. Now, there are some special cases now, mind you, that they are some of the stems they have found have been bent 6 inches from the top of the seed head. Okay, now such features defeat completely the hoax argument because a garden roller or even a wooden plank and rope is required to flatten the crop to the ground.
Right, because you're standing on it.
And it breaks them over. It mashes them, and there's completely clear, easily seen damage. Now, there's most serious crop circle researchers, they have all gotten together, they all agree that the majority of these formations are not being made by the human species, they say. And they also state that they believe that there are symbolic messages from a high intelligence that is completely unknown to them. Now, numerous people, like we talked about Colin, he's an electrical engineer. There's numerous people that have advanced degrees in engineering and science that have been involved in this because of that kind of mystery right there. They're like, let's take a look at this. Now, they believe that the evidence supports the theory that human beings could not have made the many, many thousands of crop circles that they've been found worldwide. Now, of course, people can look at the circles that look genuine at first sight, like we talked about, that was demonstrated on television.
Right.
People are like, you know, Pat saw it. He's like, dude, this looks like the real thing, the real deal. And you start looking at it, you're like, but there's more to this. It's not just pushing it down. Now, the bent node of the plant from the inside of a crop formation is elongated even, but it's undamaged. Plant stems bent by people, like we talked about, they show the damage, but they can't elongate the node. And they even, on the inside of those crop circles, the nodes have even shown exploded. They blow out.
Right, because they're cracking them. Can you crack a twig or something?
It's not even that. They don't really understand why they're blowing out. Like, they'll bend over and then someone will be exploded. Like, there's power that went through it, a heat or something. It's very, very strange. Now, there's a book been written by a Dr. E.H. Hasselhoff.
Well, that's probably David's dad.
It's exactly, or his brother. I don't know. The book's called The Deepening Complexity of Crop Circles, Scientific Research, and Urban Legends. I'm going to read you some little outsets of when they've talked to Dr. Hasselhoff. It's really interesting. It says crop circles are usually explained as the handiwork of creative pranksters. Now, not true, Dr. Hasselhoff says. Now, Dr. Hasselhoff is a former employee of Los Alamos National Laboratories, and he says this: the complexity of the crop circle phenomenon is tremendously underestimated because its true nature is unknown to the general public. Obviously, there are people trying to imitate the real thing, but the suggestion that all of these crop formations are made by men with simple flattening tools is by far insufficient to explain the well-documented observations, like unambiguous and consistent biophysical anomalies in the flattened plants inside the circles, all of which have been published in peer-reviewed scientific literature. Now, he says that there's about 10,000 crop formations have been reported worldwide since the late 70s, of which several hundred throughout here in the U.S., where the first one was reported in 1964, along that says with the increasing number of crop circle events, there's also a growing number of eyewitnesses who claim to have seen how these crop circles formed just before their eyes. And like we talked about before, several of these people claim that they were fluorescent, bright fluorescent balls would come down and hover above the fields and boom, lay them all down. Now, Dr. Hasselhoff admits this. He says, such a story sounds unbelievable, of course, but after some straightforward research, it was discovered that the plant stems inside these formations had increased in diameter as an effect of intensive heating with an astonishing circular symmetry.
That's crazy.
Yes, right?
So it's not people just out there at late at night with a board and
some
rope.
Are.
Well, no, I know. I'm talking about the ones that aren't, the 20% mm-hmm. that are unexplained. There's something going on with the physical plants themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's an unknown phenomenon.
Yes. Well, Hasselhoff says that this effect perfectly matched the radiation pattern of an electromagnetic point source at a height of 4 meters and 10 centimeters above that field. Now, unbelievable as it may seem to the layman, this is solid physical evidence that these eyewitnesses are speaking the truth. That's what he says. Now, he says he employed his analysis to other crop circles, and it was investigated by others and even obtained identical results. Now, however, the analysis failed dramatically on several man-made crop circles. Now, he goes on to conclude that the balls of light must indeed be involved in the creation of crop circles. Now, he submitted his findings to the International Peer-Reviewed Scientific Journal. I'm going to screw this up. Psychologia Planetarium.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar with that.
So it goes on. And he even says this here, that this is an important consequence. He said the hypothesis is that these balls of light are involved in the creation of crop circles is now no longer just a hypothesis, but a scientifically accepted fact until someone proves the opposite. Moreover, it promotes all further discussion about this to a scientific level. So what he's saying is now there's these eyewitnesses have saw these balls of light. Right. They saw these balls of light. They saw these circles form. They go and do all this study. They're like, it shows something electromagnetic happened here. That kind of goes hand in hand with what you've seen. So until somebody can disprove that, that's what science is looking at. It's like they talk about ball lightning. Remember we talked about? So now you start looking at this. Now, Hasselhoff's findings are in perfect agreement with the opinion from, get a load of this, the American researchers Burke, Levengood, and Talbot. Now, they suggest, of course, a while back in some early scientific articles, that it was, of course, electromagnetic effects. That's what they believed it was. It says, not one of these clearly anomalous plant alterations had been mentioned, much less explained, by the proponents of the Vandal theory. That's what they call it when people break in, of course, you know, and trample down. It says, nor can they be accounted for by the supposed methods employed to create crop formations through claims made by self-described vandals. Now, this was they call these guys the BLT team. Now, that's who they were talking about right there. That was them speaking. Now, of course, skeptics just tore into them, you know, just went after them about this whole thing. Dr. Hasselhoff backed him up and says, nah, their conclusions are right. Don't hassle the Hoff. He says, I am not performing rocket science. This is what I like. Or esoteric experiments, but trivial experimental physics. And he says, this is Hasselhoff, says, and the results are crystal clear. Something very strange is going on. No one can deny this. Anyone who claims the opposite clearly does not know what he is talking about. Whereas I consider it the duty of every scientist to figure out what on earth is going on. Now, how crazy is that?
That is crazy.
This guy with a PhD has done, like he says, it's not any crazy study. It's not any crazy scientific experiment. Simple physics. They go to looking at that, and they're like, this ain't right, man. This ain't right. Now, of course, we talked about they often appear in oilseed fields or canola fields. Now, this plant has a consistency of celery, a lot. So if the stalk is bent more than 45 degrees, it snaps.
Right, yeah.
Yet, they say in a genuine crop circle, in the formation itself, the stalks are bent flat at 90 degrees.
But they're not broke.
Not broken. They said there is not a scientist nor botanist has ever been able to explain how this is, nor has it ever been duplicated by a human being.
Right, yeah. That's what's so interesting.
Is that not crazy?
And here's another thing, is that no one's claiming that it actually is extraterrestrials that's causing this. They're not claiming that.
No, they're not claiming that.
Now, people have claimed that. And, you know, is it because they see it and it had to be something from above that they make this connection that it has to be UFOs?
Mm-hmm.
It has to be an extraterrestrial from another dimension, another galaxy. They don't know our language. They don't know how to write. So they're going to create these symbols to give us some understanding. Some of them think it's a star map even, or a language that they use, or a form of hieroglyphic, you know. So I don't know, though. Could it just as easily be fey folk or something like that? Or could it just be a natural phenomenon?
Well, when I tell you what they found, this gets a little stranger. This goes into the whole fey folk or the whole the world. It's I don't know. This is a weird thing. It says that there's other evidence of these crop circles, that they've noticed that on the floors of these plants, the way they've been swirled,
right,
that it's in mathematical proportions relative to the golden mean, that the fundamental vortex used by nature to create things like sunflowers,
right,
or shells, all right, or even, yeah, the bones, they said, relation the related bones in the human hand, the floor of these crop circles can have up to 5 layers of weaving all in counterflow to each other, with every seed head intact and placed beside each other as if arranged in a museum case.
Yeah, so how's that?
Yeah, and they even say that genuine crop circles are not perfectly round, but slightly elliptical. It says a hoax would require a fixed central rope. They couldn't achieve this adequately. Now, they say their edges are crisply defined from the flattened crop as if drawn with a compass. That's what they go on. Now, right, hoax is, it says, by comparison, they said they bear a stylistic resemblance to tufts of greasy, uncombed hair, is what this thing says. But all of the plants, of course, have been crushed and stomped down. Now, the crop circles are sometimes accompanied by trilling sounds that they've even been captured and analyzed at NASA. And they've come up with the fact that it's a harmonic frequency of 5.2 hertz and it's artificial in origin.
Hmm.
So you were right. Look, nobody's claiming that UFOs are doing this at all.
No.
Nobody's claiming that 100%. They're saying we don't know. No, the scientists that are involved, this is what I feel like it's almost being hush-hushed and pushed away more and more, because more scientists are looking at that and looking at these simple tests and like, look, we understand it would take literally them less than 5 minutes to walk out there, do a few ticks and been like, this was made by man, or come back out and go through it and be like, we don't know who made this one. This one's
built completely
different.
Yeah, I've seen some that are very complex and be like, you need a team of people.
Yes, to do it.
To do it in one night.
In one night, unless it happens. What could it be, Mugen? I mean, could it be the fey folk? Could it be some kind of interdimensional thing? Maybe it's speaking to, who knows? I mean, who really knows? I found this story whenever I was monkeying around looking into this stuff. This actually was posted last year on the Express. Now, here's what's funny is it says that a former RAF engineer says that the MI5 paid people to fake crop circles to discredit UFO research.
I can believe that.
Right? Now, he goes on to say that it paid hoaxers to create fake crop circles to discredit genuine UFO sightings as part of a Men in Black cover-up agenda. So if people seen one, they go and make a fake crop circle.
So if there was nothing to it, why would the MI5 go out of their way to do this?
Exactly.
Right, to put out this disinformation.
Exactly.
Makes me wonder, because they know something's really going on. They don't want a panic to ensue. So let's start.
We got to try to cover it up. A little, just enough to throw enough mud in the water to kind of cloudy things up. Now, David Clayton, who is an expert, it says here, on crop circles and animal mutilations, both allegedly carried out by visiting aliens, told UFO Truth Magazine International Annual Conference of a sinister plot by what he said was spooks to ensure the truth never gets out. Says Mr. Clayton, I guess I'm saying, yeah, Mr. Clayton told of seeing crop circles in the 1980s that could not have been made by hoaxers and therefore must have been alien in origin, because the plants within the circles had not been flattened by physical force, but by heat. And then this, it goes on, it talks about, he said that the MI5 were paying people to muddy the waters. And of course, like we say, whenever they see a possible UFO sighting or something, then they turn to that and they're like, well, what are we going to do? We're going to have to try to find some way to undermine what they saw. Let's go put that out there and say you just saw the headlights or something on some guys making some fake crop circles.
Right.
And the whole deal. And they're also trying to throw some kind of mud on top of this fact of the fake crop circle, because there's like the genuine research to it. It's not adding up. It's not adding up. That's the whole thing is, like, I know we bring y'all folks all kinds of wild stories. To me, like we always say, truth is stranger than fiction. This is studied. This is a studied thing that's still going on that we don't really understand. And here's what even wilder. This has happened in Texas. I stumbled across a few things here in Texas. One that happened in Fort Worth. But here's what's wild is it's not the same thing. This happened in 1968. Said that there was a cotton farmer living in South Fort Worth discovered a 5-foot diameter burnt flattened area in his field. Now, he said the circle was surrounded by a wider flattened egg-shaped area, also burnt. So it was a double burnt area.
Something landed.
It's what it sounds like. He said in the whole of the depressed area, the soil was extremely dried out like a piece of glazed pottery.
Oh, wow.
Right. Now it says upon receiving word of the circle, the United States Air Force sent a team of approximately 20 men in 2 helicopters to the site where they took soil samples and radiation readings and then quickly left. Said the farmer tried planting new cotton in the area, but the first planting didn't grow. And then the second one came up sickly. But the third planting seemed to finally take a hold unaffected.
Wow.
Now, there's several of them that goes through. There was some in Coppers County here in Texas, some down around Sabine Pass. And Sabine Pass was in 2005. But there's one that comes from Goldwaith from 2011. And the story says, I arrived at our ranch house, a place we do not live. She says, yesterday afternoon, at the time, I didn't notice the circles. I woke this morning and opened my window to find these 2 circles, one inside of the other. What puzzled me was that they were perfect circles. I took pictures from our upstairs window to show the circles. This ranch is out in the middle of nowhere, so I'm not sure how to tell when this happened. I have looked at it all day and can make no sense, so we decided to report it. The inner circle is about 30 foot in diameter. The outer circle is about 37 in diameter. The distance between the 2 circles is about 7 feet. The rings are about 2 feet wide, and the dirt just looks sort of chewed up. There's no tread marks on the lines. There are tread marks around in other areas. The roads on our property are dirt, but this is different. There is no entrance or exit. It simply looks like 2 circles, one inside of the other. I have no idea what might have caused this. Like I said, we have dirt roads, four-wheelers, motorcycles, but we couldn't get circles this perfect if we tried. This is private
in the middle
property.
Of nowhere, private property. Yeah. Somebody would have to do this in the hopes that the owner would see it.
Would stumble across.
How do they know that? I mean, several properties like this in Texas, I mean, people don't visit even every once a year.
Yeah.
Not even once a year.
Exactly.
You have this land and you just drive out there every 2 years just to check on it. So what would be the chance of you building that? I mean, there would have to be somebody that knew that they were going.
It sounded like something landed.
Yeah, but I think that's what it is.
It sounds like something landed, which is funny because now we're getting back into these deals. Okay. So that's why I touched on that. Could this be simply some sort of interdimensional thing?
Like very well maybe, could
you
be.
Know, and that's what's causing these things. This light, something has to be of some sort of intelligent design. It can't be just some sort of accidental thing. You know, accidentally, I understood if it was just one circle, just boom, and then it was just like something hit there and that was it. That's accidental. But when it starts getting into the intricacies that these crop circles are formed in, and these intricate crop circles are formed in the fact that they have been heated and bent over, well, now there's some sort of intelligent design to that crop circle.
Right.
Same as this thing out here with these circles inside of a circle. What creates that in the dirt and there's no tracks around it? And it looks charred, it looks chewed up, looks like something is spun into, you know, what does that?
Yeah.
I mean, look, and you can say, you know, tornadoes, this, that, and the other. Tornadoes don't leave circles. There's enough tornadoes in this area that we would definitely be able to go, oh, yeah, that's a circle left by a tornado. Tornado doesn't just bend things over. It tears things up.
Yeah.
So.
Destroys. I mean, very.
Exactly.
So what is creating it? So this truly still is a mystery.
It's truly still an ongoing mystery that there's all these stories that people have had some, you know, interesting encounters and stuff and hearing things and feeling things and studying stuff on these crop circles. And some people have seen them even created. But I'm at a loss because, like I said, in the back of my mind, all I could think about whenever I first wanted to look into this was, they were all hoaxed and it was just more and more people. Now, I'm not saying that they're not still being hoaxed. We know they are. We already, like I said, we know people are putting ads in their fields. People were paying. I want to say, wasn't there like an Olympic rings built at one time in somebody's field? But somebody had paid. They paid money to have the field done or something. So I know this happens. This happens often. This kind of stuff, though, is amazing to me that it's the scientific side of it is not being discussed.
Right.
Nobody's saying anything about it. That they have all this proof that they're like, these aren't all man-made, y'all. And nobody wants to hear it. And then all this RAF stuff comes out to where they know that they knew the fact that these things weren't man-made, yet they would go out and make other man-made ones. You know, it always makes me wonder how many of them had been found, I wonder. And then overnight, before the guys got there, did somebody go back in the field with a roller and they knew that they weren't man-made, but they smashed them all down anyway to make them appear man-made to try to cover up, kind of like defacing the property of whatever made them before?
Yeah, very well could be.
I think so.
I remember the first time I ever even saw a crop circle. I wasn't aware of it as a youngster. I saw it on the Led Zeppelin box set.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the first time I ever saw it. And I was always like, I wonder what that is. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And then I remember watching like Unsolved Mysteries or In Search Of or something where they were talking about crop circles. And I was like, holy cow, that's what that is? I had no idea.
Yeah.
But just like that, I was assuming that this was only taking place in the English countryside. I didn't know that it was a worldwide phenomenon, that it's occurred on every continent, almost every state, every province. These things have been going on for a long time. So just like we were talking in the very beginning of the segment, they can't all be fake.
No, they can't all be.
I mean, like we're describing, we've seen the video with the guys got the boards and the stomp. I mean, anybody could do it, of course. But who wants to do it? Like, it never occurs to me. I know what I'm going to do. Me and Cam, we're going to sneak out in the hayfield this spring. And we're going to try to make a crop circle. I mean,
yeah.
I just don't believe that they're all bullshit.
Yeah.
I think that some of them are just like when it comes to Sasquatch, when it comes to cryptozoology, when it comes to UFOs, when it comes to any of this. Of course, there's hoaxes, but there is a small percentage that I think there's something really there. And that's what I find so interesting about it. Crop circles, very, very interesting. Thank you, Cam, for sharing that with us. Let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Pretty interesting stuff. Cam, did you watch the fights this weekend?
Of course I watched the fights this weekend.
I know you did, because you were sitting right next to me.
That's right.
I loved it. I love the outcome. I think it's interesting. I think I like it when it's always unpredictable. You never know who's going to win. That's what I like so much about it. But you were talking to me about this curse, which is kind of funny. And I've heard about it before, but I didn't really think about it till the conclusion of the fights this weekend. Tell us more.
Well, and it's funny because, I mean, you and I had discussed it a little bit a while back. And you hear what's funny. I think we had actually started discussing it. Man, I want to say it's back when, was it Gustafson, I think, is whenever he lost. Anyway, what we're talking about, folks, is EA Sports. EA Sports makes a UFC game. And the very first one that they had made, that they had they put on the cover, the last two, they put on the covers of UFC 2, Ronda Rousey, and they put Conor McGregor on the covers of them. Well, both of them were, I guess you could say, Ronda Rousey was completely undefeated. And then, of course, you know, Conor hadn't lost since he got in the UFC. He was on a hype train and all this stuff. But what ends up happening? They get smoked. You know, Ronda just got ran through. And then Conor, you know, has a tough go last night. So people started looking into that. Well, they talk about some more, that it's not just them. I mean, it had been around since, they believe, 1999. They was on Madden. Garrison Hurst was actually on, and he actually shattered his ankle when he was on one of the cover variations. And it says he missed two whole seasons because of it.
Yeah, I remember that.
So there's all this talk about it, you know, that you're kind of like, I wonder what's going to happen. Don't get put on there. Don't get put on there. That's when I sing Gustafson was actually announced to be one of the cover athletes for the very first one. And then after he was even announced for the first UFC fight, or the first UFC game, Rumble and Cormier both beat him. So you're kind of like, now here's another thing that's strange. On the cover, John Jones was on that cover. Now, John Jones didn't lose, but what ended up happening? John Jones ends up getting busted for coke.
Well, it's not just UFC stuff, too, like you're saying. I mean, I remember Tiger Woods, mm-hmm. all these athletes that are pictured on these EA Sports games.
Yeah.
Something bad happens to them. I've even heard of stories in the past where they were picked and the guy's like, no, don't put me on
there.
I don't want to be on there.
Yeah.
And I think a couple season episodes of that game, a couple years of that game, they actually come out with no athletes on them because nobody wanted to do it.
Yeah, it's best if you don't. It is like the curse. I mean, they always talk about like the ESPN has a curse. There's all these sports curses. And it's funny how many people get so drawn into this. You know, they get to where it's one of those deals is, I guess, I can't think of anything that has more superstition in it than probably sports.
Yes.
I would, you know, that might be something to look into is sports superstition, because there's so much superstition. If you got to wear these socks, I got to wear these underwear, I got to have this on, I got to have that
playoff beard.
I've got to eat a certain thing. The day of the game, I only eat this certain deal for good luck, you know, and all this stuff. There's all these, I can't be on this magazine. Don't put me on that. You know, don't talk to me this. I got to listen to this song, all this stuff. But maybe, is there something to it? Is there something that, do you change the outcome? Kind of like a known experiment, like they always talk about. If you look at the experiment, you know about it. You know, it changes.
Like a butterfly effect.
I wonder if there's something like that. If there's something to this.
It could be. It could be that, or it could be you actually influence yourself by acknowledging it.
Exactly.
It doesn't bother you at all. You never even think about it. It doesn't become a thing.
Or is it because you're involved in a sport?
Right? Or like very serious superstition. You're like, oh, crap. I always flinch the arrow the same way, and I just did it wrong. Uh-oh, there goes my tournament. And then that sticks in your mind the rest of the competition, and you end up doing badly, and of course you blame it on that. But did it really have anything to do with it, or was it just because you acknowledged that?
I know a lot of jiu-jitsu guys don't wash their belt.
Yeah, I know. There's all kinds of superstitions, lots of them. Are you superstitious? You like lock them up if a black cat's crossing the road?
I'm not. I don't think I'm superstitious really at all about anything.
I can't say that I am either.
Maybe I should be. Maybe that'd make my life better.
Well, maybe, right? You're messing up all the time.
I got to be careful. Yeah, I got to be careful, especially when I'm getting out on the water. I don't want something to get me.
Right? Very interesting. Well, if you have any interesting news you'd like to share with the show, please email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can go to the website expandedperspectives.com and look for the contact tab there at the top of the top of the website. You can also call the show, 817-945-3828. You can leave us your story, or share with others why they should be listening to Expanded Perspectives. Thanks so much. Also, if you like Expanded Perspectives, don't forget we do another show called Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can head over to the website. Signing up is easy, and there's a ton of episodes over there. You're going to get access to the entire back catalog, as well as a new episode every Thursday. Cam?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Ready for a hard week of work this week?
No, but there's no getting out of it, so I'm just going to have to just bite down on my mouthpiece and walk in there.
That's right. Well, hopefully everybody has a good week. Don't work too hard. For you elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, take care. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.